Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm John Schumann with Medical Monday. It won't come as a surprise to you that gender and sexual minorities face discrimination in employment, civil rights, educational settings, and of course, perhaps especially in healthcare. Persons identifying as lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender, queer, questioning, asexual, intersex, or other identities along the spectrum have an especially challenging time finding culturally competent healthcare. This means finding doctors, nurses, and other health providers who treat each individual with the dignity and respect with which they'd expect to be treated, the golden or even platinum rule standard. As you'll hear, people identifying as transgender are often subject to what's called the trans broken arm syndrome, in which they may be asked or even forced to explain their sexuality and/or gender, even when it has no bearing on their specific health issue. My guests today are Toby Jenkins, who serves as CEO of Oklahomans for Equality and as the executive director of the Dennis R. Neal Equality Center here in Tulsa, and Taylor Ray, program coordinator for Gay-Straight Alliances and LGBTQ+ programming at Youth Services of Tulsa. They have participated in and digested a new report called the PRISM Project, Tulsa's Sexual and Gender Minority Community Needs Report, which was just released by Tulsa Reaches Out, an advisory council within the Tulsa Community Foundation. The most recent local data prior to the PRISM Project goes all the way back to 2004 and 5, so the new survey data and analysis is both timely and long overdue in helping advocate for fairness and equity among Oklahoma's gender and sexual minorities. Toby Jenkins of Oklahomans for Equality and Taylor Ray of Youth Services of Tulsa are my guests today on Studio Tulsa Medical Monday. Toby Jenkins and Taylor Ray, welcome to Medical Monday. Let's start by having you tell us about Tulsa Reaches Out. Just for our listening audience, what is Tulsa Reaches Out that conducted this survey?
Tulsa Reaches Out is some community leaders and some of the foundations who have committed resources that help serve and sustain some of the work that's being done for lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender, and queer persons here in Northeast Oklahoma.
And this, it's called the PRISM Project. It's a 73-page report based on 800 completed surveys that were done anonymously. And the research, as I understand it, was contracted out to the University of Oklahoma, the Hope Research Center. How are you able to help cull respondents for the survey?
Well, we kind of had a mass share where everybody we knew and then individuals who we didn't know through our social media campaigns and through our marketing efforts and just through the constituents that we serve through our programs across the region, we tried to encourage them to take this opportunity is to stand up for yourself, advocate for yourself, give us the data that needs to exist to validate what we know what life is like here in Oklahoma for LGBTQ+ persons.
And Tulsa Reaches Out created a steering committee of about 10 to 20 different organizations that are doing LGBTQ+ work in this area to pull on their reach as well to bring in as many individuals as possible.
And did the steering committee have a lot of say in terms of the survey design, in terms of what data points you wanted? Or, and this is part of a broader question, my understanding is that this PRISM Project, this report, is updating some data from more than 15 years old. Mm-hmm. And so as I understand it, you were looking, both of your organizations, or a multitude of organizations really, that serve some of these minority communities, was looking to understand really what the perceptions and the needs of the communities are in order to better advocate for them. So we were looking at data from, was it 2004 or 2005?
Yeah, 2004, the report I think was done in 2004 and then released in 2005. So the information that we were looking for, I think probably was directed by the committee because of the work that we do with our constituents. You know, it was a little bit different than from 2004 because the climate has changed in many areas and there are issues that are more significant to us today, things that we're, as a culture and a society, that we're finally addressing. Maybe things that existed 15 years ago, but nobody had bothered to wrap their minds about it. And so we made sure that there were several components that we just wanted to know what people's experience was like in everything from healthcare settings to their interactions with faith communities, their interactions with law enforcement. So it expanded on a lot of those data points because of the developing work that we have with our different agencies and organizations here in the region.
And the steering committee was a very integral part in deciding what all that was going to look like, because for the most part, they picked organizations that came from different demographics, and hoping to bring all of those demographics together and knowing what was most important within those communities and making sure that we touched on that in that survey.
And some of the findings were broken out, obviously, into categories or topics. And so one was on health and healthcare access, another on mental health that, of course, we look at sort of on this program. But Taylor, you're at Youth Services of Tulsa, and one focus was youth experiences. And you told me that I think 12% of the survey respondents were folks under 18. That seems pretty, not a huge number, but pretty significant in that it's often hard to survey youth because of issues of parental consent. Or tell us about the youth you serve.
So our program at Youth Services of Tulsa serves GSAs in middle school, high school, and college settings. And we also do a lot of different things within the community so that there's space for LGBTQ plus youth throughout the community. So that's a lot of where those youth came from. We also did a ton of tabling events. We went to some different pride parades, festivals, those sorts of things, went to all kinds of different events and things that were going on around like sexual health. We went to a couple of different school places. So anywhere that we were going, we took that survey with us and asked those youth to fill out that survey. So that's where we ended up. It was just over 100 individuals who were, I believe, it was categorized under 19. But
under 19.
Yeah. So,
and just for our listeners, GSAs, when I was coming up, that was Gay Straight Alliances, and it's sort of changed the acronym.
It can still be that.
Okay.
A lot of, there's been a move towards Gender and Sexuality Alliance, so it's more inclusive. It's not just gay and straight. You need everybody there to be able to affect change. So it's kind of a move to that. Yeah.
Now, what were some of the findings that leapt out at either of you from the new report?
The overwhelming majority of the constituents who participated in the assessment almost unanimously agreed that they felt like that their greatest need was access to competent mental health care. I think anybody in this kind of work maybe is not surprised about that, but I was impressed that there was such a consensus and such a uniformity across all the assessment from all age groups, all demographics, felt like they needed to be able to have access to mental health providers who understood them and could help them as they deal with their life traumas.
And one of the things, it's true for really all of us, I think, regardless of community of origin or community of belonging, that mental health is hard to find. And so it's maybe not
hard
surprising.
To find, and it's been defunded in our state, and it's being sidelined as not the most important issue of our time. But this assessment, especially for the LGBTQ persons that we work with every day, we know from personal interaction that that is what they're trying to access and request the most often. But it says this in the survey that they felt like this was priority one for them.
And Taylor, as far as the youth are concerned, that was also, I think, a very high need, a perceived high need was mental health services. And I guess one thing that surprised me a little, but maybe didn't surprise me so much, is that youth who responded to the survey had very high ACE scores.
Yes, I believe it was the total overall participants, but I think it was 37% had 4 ACE scores or higher. And that is significantly higher than even the national rate. And again, that was all of the participants. But yes, our youth in general are experiencing ACE at a much higher rate than the national level, simply because of resources that are not fully available to them. There's not a lot of organizations that are doing integral work that includes LGBTQ+. A lot of times for them to get those services, it has to be an LGBTQ+ specific organization. And that's where a lot of the things are lacking for them.
You're listening to Studio Tulsa. It's Medical Monday. I'm John Schumann. And my guests today are Toby Jenkins, who is the CEO of Oklahomans for Equality, and he's also the executive director of the Dennis Arneal Equality Center, and Taylor Ray, who is the coordinator for GSAs and LGBTQ persons and programming at Youth Services of Tulsa. And we are talking about the PRISM Project, PRISM, P-R-I-S-M, which is a just-released report on Tulsa's sexual and gender minority community needs, and that came out just this month. And it was from some work that was done. The survey was actually conducted in May of this year. And Toby, you told me a little bit offline, you were hoping that maybe we could have extended the duration of the survey to try to get more respondents, but it was done in a fairly concise fashion, but still had a significant amount of statistical power.
Yeah, we're told that 800 participants is a significant survey and that we need to be happy with that. I felt like that we could have, if given just a little more time, we could have maybe found 1,600 people to participate. But that those 800 individuals who went through the lengthy process of the assessment, they told us information that was now vital to us, and we can now share this with public policymakers and decision makers in our region. I mean, there were a couple of things. We wanted to know what people's interaction was with law enforcement. We found that transgender persons and people of color who identify as LGBTQ did not have positive experiences with law enforcement. We found out that faith continues to be a struggle. Faith and sexuality and gender identity continue to be a struggle for individuals living here in the middle of the country. But we did find that compared to the study in 2004, there does seem to be some improvement. There does seem to be improvement with more welcoming, inclusive faith communities. But almost everybody that was surveyed who still were actively involved in faith communities had had some awkward experiences and some uncomfortable experiences even in their faith communities. We also found out that intimate partner violence and domestic violence was higher than we had previously thought because we were going on data that was being provided for us by the Tulsa Police Department. And so these survey participants made us aware that perhaps we're not serving them properly or educating them properly on how to deal with intimate partner violence. So that was real disturbing. There were some really positive things. We found out that employment experiences in the workplace have definitely improved since 2004. Most of that is because most employers, especially our major employers in the city of Tulsa, have added non-discrimination policies that guarantee that their employees will be treated fairly in the workplace. And then we saw significant growth where especially several employers have added health care protections for their transgender employees. So it shows up in the survey that there are some places that things are improving, welcoming faith communities, employment security is improving. And then what was a surprise to me is access to health care. How many individuals that participated identified and said they had insurance, but the flip side was that they still were having awkward conversations or did not necessarily feel comfortable or safe with their healthcare provider, being able to talk to their healthcare provider about their unique needs.
And another component of that, too, though, is that, again, our POC communities were underinsured or uninsured, so they were still struggling. I believe it was something about like 8% or so said that they were not insured. But of the Latinx POC communities, that number jumped up to like 26-28%.
Yeah, so by POC, you mean people of color.
People of color.
Right. And so, yeah, so I'm looking at a snapshot here on health and healthcare access from the report. And I, too, was kind of pleasantly surprised that the uninsured rate among these survey respondents was low. I mean, low in quotes, I'll put it, 8.6%. And the national rate is 8.8%, and that is lower both in the 2005 study and is also, I would say, lower than the rate in Oklahoma, where we think that we're the second highest uninsured state in the country because we have not expanded Medicaid. But then those, when you separate it out by people who identify as African-American or Latinx, it jumps way up to 21% for African-American and 26% for Latinx, as you mentioned, Taylor. So there definitely is a perception, or not a perception, but actual the uninsured rate is very high. I mean, that's way too high for getting people into care. And then, Toby, you were mentioning that even though we can, you know, be happy, I guess, that that the rates reflect on the respondent side reflects that of the general population, which I guess is a worthy aspiration. But finding people who are competent or who for whom you can have an experience in a healthcare setting that's not awkward, I mean, that's a whole sort of different kettle of fish. And I guess I'm understanding that both of you at your agencies, you'll get a hold of a name or a provider or a list of folks, whether it's mental health or a physician or dentist or whomever, and you will then start referring folks, clients, out to those doctors or dentists or providers, and they wind up sometimes feeling a little besieged.
Yeah, I mean, you can call it, you can title it however you want to title it. Either call them LGBTQ-friendly medical providers, mental health providers, or LGBTQ-competent healthcare providers or mental health providers, but it's still the same tent. finding access to individuals that LGBTQ persons will feel comfortable with. I noticed that in the survey it says 9% of the participants said that they had had some really awkward conversations and been really asked some very intrusive things by their medical providers that had nothing to do with their health care. It also says that 24% of the transgender participants said they had to educate their own healthcare provider on what their medical needs were. And so we see this as a real essential need for our survival, that for us to be able to be healthy and for us to be able to be emotionally happy and fulfilled, we're going to have to see that our medical schools and our universities are adequately training future mental health providers and future doctors and nurses and medical providers, making sure that they're culturally competent, they're culturally aware in working with LGBTQ persons.
And hiring LGBTQ plus persons.
Absolutely.
To,
visibility.
To do those trainings,
right.
Rather than a person who may be cisgender, heterosexual, then running those trainings to teach other cisgender, heterosexual people. That's not exactly cultural competency. And what Toby's speaking of is actually, it's called, there's a term for it. It's called the trans broken arm syndrome. The idea is that if you're someone who is part of the trans community and you go in, you have broken your arm and you go in to seek care for your broken arm, oftentimes it becomes about your trans identity. So they ask you all of these questions about who you are, how you do things. I'm of trans experience, and so I get questions all the time that have nothing to do with my treatment, has nothing to do with fixing the broken arm. It has everything to do with them feeling like they have the authority at that time to then require you to engage in a lot of emotional labor in order to answer all the questions that they feel is necessary. It's also kind of alluding to the idea that somehow my arm is broken because I'm trans, which is also not true. people break arms. It doesn't matter who that person is. It becomes very difficult to then seek medical care knowing that you're going to have to go through this whole thing, especially if it's a new provider. If you had a terrible experience with your last provider, knowing that there's a really good possibility you're going to have to go back through that again is daunting. It's re-traumatizing. And you'll hear these stories from other people in the community as well, because obviously healthcare is one of the things that we try to access the most and have the least success in. So you share out your experiences so that people don't have to relive that. And it does get very difficult to find someone who is truly competent and is not invasive and will treat you with dignity and also not be a gatekeeper to those services. So saying that their own personal judgment values are somehow related to whether or not you can receive that service is another barrier entirely.
I mean, the optimist in me wants to imagine certainly that no healthcare provider would re-traumatize an individual just on the basis of their gender identity or sexuality. But the optimist in me would hope that somebody would be asking questions of, like you were telling us before, about education and saying, like, I want to learn, like, teach me, which is a different mm-hmm. framework altogether from casting aspersions or mm-hmm. suggesting, of course, that your gender identity or sexuality somehow was the cause of your
sure.
medical calamity. So I could see why it would be very hard work to have to literally like defend your existence or your
right. Are we allowed to do like shout outs?
Sure. Here?
Okay. So a great resource for healthcare providers is it's called the Q Card Project. And it's actually this card for individuals who are LGBTQ plus to identify themselves. But the bottom of it is a tearaway so that you can hand that to the healthcare provider and it gives them an opportunity to educate themselves instead of taking that time during an appointment to do it. But also then that card can then stay with the person's medical information. So for instance, for a trans person, the name that's on your legal documentation may not be the name you go by. So then the whole office knows to go by that name. It gives you an opportunity to state your pronouns, and it also gives you an opportunity to identify. So sometimes healthcare providers say if you're a person who identifies as a lesbian, they decide that there are certain things that they don't need to tell you about just simply because you're a lesbian. So for instance, they may not go over certain birth control, assuming that you're a lesbian and you're not going to have sex with someone who has a penis. So it's a great resource, and there's a lot of different kinds that you can have. And organizations who are working with LGBTQ plus people, it's a great thing to have on hand because healthcare systems can be so daunting and can be so overwhelming for LGBTQ plus people.
I have not heard of that. The Q Card.
The Q Card Project.
Q Card Project. You're listening to Studio Tulsa. It's Medical Monday. I'm John Schumann, and my guests today are Toby Jenkins, CEO of Oklahomans for Equality and Executive Director of the Dennis R. Neal Equality Center. Also are talking with Taylor Ray, who is the Program Coordinator at U-Services of Tulsa for GSA programs and LGBTQ plus programs. And we're talking about the PRISM Project, which is an updated report on the community needs of Tulsa's sexual and gender minorities, which just came out and surveyed over 800 people anonymously to ascertain the needs of Tulsa's gender and sexual minorities. And I wanted to ask both of you, we focus on Tulsa here. We're the second largest city in Oklahoma and, the major metro. But there is some rural component of this as well. Both of your organizations, Youth Services and the Equality Center, both serve a wide array of the population, not just here in Tulsa, but for many of our surrounding counties. So how were rural individuals included in this as well?
They did participate. There are at least 9 rural counties where Oklahomans for Equality has chapters, where we have well-established chapters and connections with mental health providers, schools, and faith community leaders. So we were able to access those, and we have that data. And that was really the first time they had ever been asked to participate, because we know this from the work we do. The experience living within the Metroplex, the Tulsa area, or of the Oklahoma City area, or maybe some other larger cities we have, that experience is entirely different for individuals who are living in smaller communities across the state. And so you can see that reflected in some of the data, especially access to mental health care and their experiences. I noticed that a lot of the individuals who lived in the rural areas, their experiences with faith communities reflected that they were still dealing with the low presence of welcoming, affirming, inclusive faith communities in their communities. And so you can definitely see that in some of that data. We wanted to make sure they were included because we're interacting with them. I mean, Taylor travels all over the state to be at our little pride picnics that happen, and his team is there working especially with LGBTQ youth and making sure they have access to those resources. And so whether they're traveling there or not, they are a resource for especially school counselors and students who are trying to start gay-straight alliances in their schools.
The steering committee also worked to have individuals who had connections within rural communities that are in some ways serving LGBTQ plus individuals. So that was another pull. And I know our organization specifically, we would make sure to go to events that were in rural areas, doing what we can. We have the privilege of being able to represent a national organization called GSA Network. So we do serve the whole state when it comes to starting GSAs. If anyone's facing discrimination from their school systems or anything like that, they can contact us and we can work with them. So we do our best to provide services wherever within the state, even though we do physically only serve Tulsa County. But yeah, we did several different things to try and make sure that the rural community was included. And even though we were aiming for just Tulsa, the bottom line is that it's going to be great when we're able to capture the entire state. And any data is better than no data. So,
and it was, we call it rural, but the national LGBTQ movements, they consider Tulsa and Oklahoma City rural. They consider Oklahoma rural, period. And then we are kind of guilty of, we see any city outside of the Metroplex, we consider it rural. But most of our chapters are in cities of 10 to 30 or 40, 50,000. But what we can tell you is when we are there and they have their little pride picnic, there will be especially LGBTQ students and their families. They will drive 30 or 40 or 50 miles from little high schools where there's maybe only 40 in their graduating class. And they will drive over there. This will be the closest they can get to a pride picnic. Mm-hmm. And we have that interaction with them. And so because of that, we've been able to make those contacts with those individuals and tried to encourage them to participate.
Is there a sense from the PRISM, PRISM, PRISM project, or the report we're talking about, from the 15-year gap in data, that there is more ability for, say, rural youth to be able to be out or is that you just can't make that kind of blanket assessment without on an anonymous survey?
Well, this survey was actually really important when it comes to youth input because it was the first time that, youth were considered part of the survey. So it wasn't actually until 2009 that they were able to start getting a snapshot of what the youth experience looked like. So this was the first time that youth had been integrated from the very beginning. And I would say that I don't believe that it is wholly safe for youth to be out. For instance, just right now, this current administration has pulled back on enforcement of federal guidance. And those federal guidances are in place to protect LGBT plus students. And since they're not going to be enforced, if those were to be disregarded, it makes it hard for youth to advocate for themselves. So that's where we come in to be advocates for them. And we've seen the data shows that it's youth are less likely to experience hope, less likely to be engaged, are more likely to consider suicide ideation, are more likely to attempt suicide simply because they don't have those support systems in place. Yeah, I mean, it's when it comes to that, the data is rough to experience, but it shows that there's a lot of room for us to grow. There's a lot of ways that we can continue to show up for youth and to incorporate them into our larger community.
The most alarming statistics, I think, from the report that I was able to glean were that a quarter of SGM, sexual and gender minority participants who responded to the survey, a quarter reported serious psychological distress, and two-thirds of those that were 18 and under. So yeah, it does reflect some serious distress. But I guess perhaps the most alarming thing was these rates of suicidality. So that's suicidal consideration or actual suicide attempts, strikingly high for really all of the populations that you looked at.
Yeah. And a lot of that comes down to if the youth don't see themselves having a support system, then it falls apart. So if you're able to establish GSAs, if they're able to establish a safe person, that's great, but it needs to grow from there. So even if a school were to, say, have policy around anti-discrimination when it comes to being LGBTQ+, the accountability needs to be there. There needs to be a system that's enforcing it, and that there's something on the other end that if someone is not following that policy, if they're not following that law, that they're able to enter into mediation, they're able to enter into training, they're able to have some sort of accountability to that behavior, because this is showing that the youth are seriously affected by not having these support systems in place. And oftentimes, with Oklahoma being such a large faith community, there's, as the data showed as well, there's a real fear of rejection within faith communities. So that's another place in which they may not be able to find those support systems. We're an at-will state, which means that we're not covered in our employment to be safe from being fired. And then oftentimes organizations, they're not integral to LGBTQ plus youth. You have to find specific organizations that have LGBTQ plus outreach. And so they have to find these little pockets. And if they don't find those pockets, they're a lot less likely to survive. So we really try to focus on their resilience. We really try to focus on their leadership. And we really try to focus on making sure that they have agency in their spaces and that they know how to take up space because they deserve to be here.
Taylor Ray of Youth Services of Tulsa and Toby Jenkins from the Dennis Arneal Equality Center and Oklahomans for Equality, thank you very much for taking us through this and for joining us today on Medical Monday.
Thank you, Dr. Schumann.
If you'd like more information about the PRISM Project, we'll link to it at the show's website at publicradiotulsa.org/programs/Studio Tulsa. Well, that's our show for this Medical Monday. Studio Tulsa is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests are their own and do not necessarily reflect those of KWGS or the University of Tulsa. For Studio Tulsa, I'm John Schumann with Medical Monday. Thanks for listening.